Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking about student debt. It is one of those things that in Ireland we have Martin. Who do you want to tell the remind listeners who your hero is? Political hero.
It was a former Fianna Fáil politician and he was the first man to, well he was the man who introduced free secondary school education. It made a huge difference to Ireland. It brought Ireland from the dark ages, educationally wise. And it really was such an opening up to parts of society that had never had an education before.
Yeah, but we've kind of gone backwards because we introduced my generation introduced free fees in universities and colleges, if you remember. And then we've slowly reintroduced fees by the back door. It's been how do I put this without getting myself in trouble with some of our university listeners? It's been one of these things of fees by stealth, and it concerns me because we're going to talk to Braxton Bevington from the Debt Collective in the US now, and he is going to explain to us what they're doing. And I tell you guys, if you don't think this matters to you, it really does, because this is the sort of stuff that will impact everybody if you're not careful. Braxton, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about debt.
Yeah. Look, do you want to first of all just give us an oversight? Like, most people who listen to our podcast tend to be tuned into a lot of events, but they might have missed out on some of the things that you guys are doing and what your campaign is all about.
Sure. So generally, we have an enormous crisis of indebtedness in the U.S. Housing debt, medical debt, credit card debt, and student loan debt. Many of these debt crises, which don't exist in other countries because they have universal health care or because they have public college, unfortunately, we do not yet. And so we're sort of running a campaign right now that's focusing on student loan debt in particular, because we believe it is one of the sort of easier debts to cancel or abolish. So right now we are at $1.8 trillion worth of student debt here in the United States. That's because of, you know, sort of since the era of Reagan, Ronald Reagan, in the decades in the past, we have steadily starved state funding of federal dollars to go towards public education. And so universities have to hike up the tuition for everyone else, which has led people to take out enormous sums of loans in order to go to college. And not only is this very bad because we believe education should not be a commodity, but it's hindering the economy, it's hindering regular people's lives. People are sleeping in cars, people are not buying homes, people are not starting families or small businesses. Really, these things that can boost the economy because they're being saddled by this enormous amount of loan. The average person has about $35,000 worth of student loans.
Just want to say that again. $35,000 is the average. Now, that is an enormous sum of money to come if you're emerging into the workforce, as they say, and trying to actually make your way. And it does. It is a legacy issue of what is essentially, as you put it, the commodification of education. And we would argue the neoliberal model that has, you know, sought to make everything a market and yep. Put it in that fashion. What are you, I mean, you want this eradicated. What is Joe Biden's kind of ideas? There's talk of, you know, $10,000, $20,000. There's all of this kind of middle ground. Obviously, we'd call that centrist logic that doesn't exactly get it done. But what are the kind of on the table? What's in the ether?
Well, it's important to note Joe Biden ran on his actual policy. He ran on the immediate cancellation of a minimum of $10,000. And so my understanding of that is that means we're going to do $10,000 a minimum right now, and then maybe more in the future. So that's what he ran on. And then later he actually endorsed more. He actually, supported cancellation for people who are going to historically Black colleges and universities, people who went to public colleges whose families' incomes are below $125,000. So he actually promised much more than that. But recently, you know, he sort of made an offhand comment to suggest that he was only in favor of $10,000. But we know that the executive authority that the president has is that he can cancel any federal educational loan that he wants to, because that's the power that the department has.
And is there, it affects different groups differently in that it's not an even-handed, I suppose tax is what you'd really call it, a tax on education, but it's not even-handed. And some groups are affected far more than others. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please, Braxton?
Yeah, so I don't think it's any secret to any listeners that we have disparities in the United States, racial and gender disparities, class disparities. So 2/3 of student loan debt are held by women. The majority of student loan debt disproportionately is held by Black women. And so we're seeing this sort of racial and gender inequities really persist in student loan debt and how much borrowers owe, quote unquote, owe to the federal government. This is largely due to, there are enormous racial wealth gap where Black and Hispanic borrowers don't have the generational wealth because they were stripped of generational wealth in years past, don't have the generational wealth to be able to afford to pay for college upfront as opposed to their peers. So they're forced to borrow. 91% of Black people who enroll in college borrow some type of loan in order to go to college. So we were all told to go to college. We love the idea of people getting higher education. That is a pillar of our society, and so we can build roads and bridges that are safe. But when you have a segment of the population that either can't afford to go to college or can only attend college if they mortgage their future, then we basically are saying that is an unjust debt, that's an illegitimate debt, and it's affecting all of us, but not all of us equally, and we should just cancel this illegitimate debt, which would actually boost the economy and start to close those racial and gender wealth gaps.
It would actually be a form of reparations.
I think you could look at it in a lot of ways.
Now, you're going to be kicking me now, but it's one of those where we interrupt this broadcast to bring you a pitch, because we genuinely are going down the road whereby if you're on board with us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, you're going to get an ad-free version of the podcast. You can just listen straight through and not have to hear me go jazz hands and rattling my bucket and asking you. But I suppose why we're doing this, Martin, is because we have to.
Yeah. These things don't work for free. You know, we have to get the money to keep producing, to keep putting the podcast out there. It takes time. It takes money. It takes energy.
It takes an effort. Like, work has value. That's the truth. I mean, work, if you get something out of it, give something back. And I mean, most of our podcasts go out for free. Not everything. We do have a good bit of content that we keep back behind the paywall. Some of it for reasons that we'd be afraid to get in trouble with if it went out
publicly.
Well,
we haven't got there yet, but there is always the risk.
Yeah, well, actually, more often than not, it's me who gets annoyed and says, no, we can't put that out.
I'm quite, throw it out there. Let's see what happens.
But there's a lot of other content behind the paywall. If you are going to go and have a look, here's the thing. Go sign up. There is tiers. We have a tip jar, so it's $2.50 a month. That's just if you there's nothing extra for it, but that's a tip. You're throwing us $2.50. If you come in at $5.50, that gets you access to every podcast on the platform across the network. And when you go into it, you'll say my private RSS link, and that's yours. So you take that link, that because you've signed up, this Patreon generates it, and you paste it into whatever your player is, whether it's Acast or Apple or whatever you're using, and you're going to get this little green tortoise is going to pop up on your thing, and that'll be where all of them come. So it'll be all your echo chambers, reboots, police, Glow West, two Norris, Rewind is coming, Built Different is coming. You know, we have loads of stuff in the pipeline, and you get all that for $5.50.
If you want the change, Tony, you really have to invest in it.
I just think it makes total sense to me that we could have a place where we want to continue to do this, but we can't do it unless people help us to keep growing. I mean, we like it was ads or sponsors. Do you remember the conversation I had with people saying about we'll insert sponsors into your dynamically insert sponsors into your podcast? And I'm going, yeah, it wouldn't be any good if I'm giving out about finance and you have Be With AIB and you know, coming in.
Yeah, if I'm doing bogus self-employment and there's a delivery ad, it's great. Yeah.
Well,
no,
well, what I actually said was true as God. I said, okay, we might consider, because we're pretty desperate, to be honest with you. So we considered it, and I said, but we'd have to walk the walk. So it would have to be people who pay a living wage, recognize unions, and have an ethical business. Guess what?
Yeah, there's not many of them out there, Tony.
No one was interested. So it's not worth our while pursuing that sort of avenue, because we just don't appeal to that demographic. And we hope that enough of you will think you don't want that crap in your podcast anyway.
Insertion of ads just takes away the control, takes away the flow. If we're having a good conversation, we like to stick to it, you know?
Yeah, well, this is why we're interrupting you now, telling you that if you don't want this, just throw us a couple of quid and you'll get the ad-free version. That's the way to do it. It is, again, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link will be in the blurb, and we'll let you get back to the podcast now. Thanks.
I think you could look at it in a lot of ways. I mean,
is it only next year? I think I'm right in saying it's only next year that the African-American community or the people of color community in the U.S. will have actually been, I'm going to use this word with air quotes and you won't see it on the podcast, folks, be free longer than they were in slavery existed. So that's how long slavery existed in the United States. And, you know, that intergenerational wealth was ruled out by law. And then when slavery was abolished, laws like Jim Crow and these other aspects that were done, you know, segregation in the workforce, you know, certain ways where people of color could work. And that all of that has led to this position whereby it's, you know, in other terms, we call it colonialism, we call it imperialism. We have to acknowledge that is the I'm sorry now, but I just feel very strong that we have to understand from this point of view that it's certainly not just something that, you know, because in Ireland, we have this awful thing where they'll say moral hazard. If you give it to them, the moral hazard of why give it to that person and not this person? And, you know, it needs to be kind of called out for what it actually is. It is only almost a way of doing something to readjust the scales a little bit.
Yeah. And we have we hear that all the time where people say, you know, if you're going to cancel student debt, what about me, this taxpayer that I guess doesn't have student debt and wants some money on their own? Well, first of all, you know, they should be satisfied that they're not burdened by student loan debt, which is incredibly not protected by consumer financial protection laws, as opposed to other types of debts. And so, you know, we have loans that are upwards of 8, 12, and 14% interest rates that are just ballooning, that grow at enormous rates, which is why people can't keep up with these types of debts. So, you know, that falls under a fundamental, you know, misguided notion that this is going to, you know, go towards certain people that don't deserve it. And, you know, one thing that we know is rich people in the United States don't have student loan debt, because either they could afford to pay for college up front because they were rich, or if they came out of college and are rich now, then they probably paid off those student loans because it wouldn't make sense to have to be paying on debt. So, you know, in the case that there's a slim chance that a couple of rich people somehow with $200,000 worth of debt, but make, you know, $3 million per year worth of income, if we're worried about, you know, a couple of those people slipping through, then we should just have a wealth tax higher income tax.
I love it. I love it. You're speaking my language.
Can I just ask, does the cost of going to college limit access to certain, you know, certain professions so that it reinforces a status quo that doesn't help those people who need to access education on an equal basis in the first place?
Exactly. And so not only are that's why we're pushing for not only for free college, but freeing college, because right now we, you know, there's sums of people who are going to college thinking about how this debt will impact their future and are making career decisions based off of that, rather than people being able to follow passions or do something that they've actually wanted to do that they maybe would be better at. You know, instead they're going into, you know, what are defined to be high paying jobs or things that they'll be able to pay their loans back at an enormous rate, rather than which is a really corrupted ideology, right? So now we have people who are going to law school, but because the loans are so high, they're working for these major law firms who maybe aren't doing good things. Rather than saying, you know, I actually just wanted to be a public defender, but I just can't afford to be a public defender.
I wanted to come out and give back, but I couldn't. No,
exactly.
Because no, it's funny because we spoke to a couple of people in the last few days about there's been riots recently on the streets of Belfast that we haven't seen in many years, and a lot of that came back to a lack of it stems from inequality and some, you know, lack of progress in terms of educational attainment and social mobility. And when you take away social mobility, you take away that sort of stuff. This is where, you know, people become even further disenfranchised. I do want to go specifically to the debt strike itself and what you guys are actually doing. So like, you know, I know what you're doing, but tell our listeners why what you guys are doing in terms of the actual debt strike.
Yeah, so I'll start with a couple of years ago in 2015, there were individuals who were defrauded by predatory colleges called Corinthian College. This was several years ago. And they were defrauded because we have predatory for-profit colleges. And instead of, you know, making these enormous payments, some of them could and many of them could not pay, they decided, well, let's collectively come together and refuse to pay. They sort of politicized their refusal to pay back their debts, which we call a debt strike. And so they came together, refused to pay, which obviously took a hit and drew some national attention. And long story short, many of them were able to get their debts canceled because the federal government canceled those loans. We do have a little bit of sympathy, it seems like, for people who are defrauded. We're building off of that model of a debt strike from the Corinthian 15 and expanding that right now where we have the Biden Jubilee 100. So this is 100 individuals who are currently not paying back a dime of their student loans, and there's safe ways to get to, you know, paying $0 per month, whether it's administrative forbearance or defaulting or, you know, these other sorts of things. So the point is that they are not paying back any of their loans as sort of a, which is a debt strike. There's sort of a way of saying, you know, we're actually going to collectively politicize the debt that we owe. We see our debt as someone else's asset. And so since our debt is someone else's paycheck, if we refuse to pay, then you all will not get the benefits of, you know, our student loan debt, which is politicizing this movement of student debt. So it's called the Biden Jubilee 100. It's added pressure to force President Biden to cancel all student loan debt. And obviously that is in coordination with the COVID-19 crisis that has hit the United States particularly hard. So that debt strike right now, which is supposed to be for 100 days, there's 100 strikers for 100 days, but we know that the 100 day mark is sort of arbitrary, that Biden could cancel it on day 104 and we'd be more than happy for him to cancel on day 105 or something.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that listeners see this in perspective for what it is. Like we've seen we're not immune to we call, Martin, you've called for rent strikes in the past. We've called for these kind of things and how you actually do, how do I put this, put manners on capitalism sometimes. It can be done. In the context of the wider movement, though, America, and you can absolutely correct me, we've just come out of a a difficult presidential election. You know, difficult. It was. Yeah, yeah. I've been soft about it, but we have seen ultimately the more, how do I would see, we'd call Biden a kind of center right guy. He's not very left in our minds.
No, he's not.
But I do think the electorate is slightly more left, particularly that, like, you see the it's derogatory when we call some of the senators like Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and how they're all referred to. But ultimately, they get elected really, really, really well. So something is changing there. And hopefully, you know, Biden campaigned a little bit more on the left and then immediately moved back to the right when you get elected, which is traditional. But how are you finding it? Is it easier to get publicity to these sort of things? Is it easier to get the message across? And are there more people interested in the message of free education?
Public college polls extremely well, and I think even more so does student debt cancellation, because people largely understand that this is a racial and gender and economic crisis, and they understand, you know, there's 45 million Americans with student loan debt. And so chances are people know someone who went to college, which they usually understand to be a fairly good decision, you know, for society. And they sympathize with people that truly cannot pay these student loans back. And you're absolutely right on Biden. And you know, I'm not sure how much it helps to name it, but it's the truth that, you know, he is a large part of the problem of why we have a student debt crisis. He, you know, truly, truly did not help, made things much worse in terms of borrower protections and consumer rights, specifically for student loans, which would make it all the sweeter for him to be the one to have to cancel student loan debt. But student debt is popular, but I don't think that is, you know, the argument of why we believe that we can win, because, you know, we're reaching a point where student debt is polling, you know, just well enough, or Biden is coming to the left far enough. We just believe in debtor power organizing. We believe that, you know, we could sort of force the same type of leverage, even you know, on a more center right, or even on the right, type of presidential figure, because just the power of our dollars. So I would prefer Joe Biden to be the president other than Donald Trump, but, you know, our organizing is still going to be the same, that we're going to still leverage, you know, our debt in a similar way that workers come together, right, to say we want better wages, we want you know, better work, improved working conditions, where we debtors can come together and say we want write downs and cancellations, and we want to, you know, negotiate policies that address the core of things, which is how things are financed in the United States.
We talk in Ireland a lot about the locked out generation, and the locked out generation, they can't afford to buy housing. They can't afford to move on with their lives. They're stuck in this place where their parents would have owned a house, a car, got married, had kids, whatever it was. But they're locked out by the cost of living. Now, the cost of living in the States is worse with paying for education. Is there any talk about how bad it is economically to have a locked out generation?
It is so incredibly devastating to have millions of people who don't have $400 worth of emergency savings should, you know, they bust a tire or, you know, something happened to their car. And it makes for a truly unstable economy, which hurts everyone, which leads to these giant income gaps, these giant wealth gaps that largely all of our money is going to the Jeff Bezoses of the world, because we don't have any, we have bad tax laws, and we don't incentivize the things we should incentivize, and we don't tax the people who we should be taxing. But not only, you know, not only is it bad for the economy, you know, I can certainly make that argument. I think people know that so well by now. But one of the things I've been thinking about, and I think we've been thinking about at the Debt Collective, is how truly unfortunate it is that when we have this sort of locked out generation of people, that it really starts to set up the economic conditions that brought us Donald Trump and fascism so much so that it leads these people to literally storm the Capitol. And I'm the last person to say this is like economic anxiety, which is why these, you know, people storm the Capitol. It's definitely because of, you know, xenophobia and racism and all of these other isms. However, at the same time, you know, we largely see this connection between when you have these poor economic conditions, you know, there's scapegoats have to be created somewhere. And so that's when people start to blame others who don't look like them or who don't come where they come from. That's what leads to fascism.
I'm right in saying, I think it was for the first time I heard that, and I can say this on this podcast, that arsehole Tucker Carlson more or less quoting the Great Replacement Theory recently on Fox News. I mean, where are we when that's actually mainstream and one of the biggest, most watched TV shows in the entire United States? And I think you've put that much better than I can in terms of how that creates it foments the outrage and says that the problem is not Jeff Bezos, it's your neighbor who you know, he's a scrounger, as we might say here. You know, he's not pulling his weight. He's the problem. It's also true, factually, to say that the generation now, that unfortunately for you, Braxton, your generation is worse off than your parents' generation were economically than they were at the same stage of their lives and their life cycle, whether it was educational attainment or employment or the ability to, you know, have a one family income and maybe buy a house or pay decent rent or whatever it is. All of that has been made much more difficult. In the main, though, I do want to return to the economic argument that you've hinted at. Just give us kind of the highlights of how you see it, why it would be something that rather than, how do I put this, a debt relief would be like an injection of capital, of people capital into the economy.
Yeah, so when you have tens of millions of Americans who are making $400, $500, $700, a grand or more payments every single month, and that balance yet seems to continue to increase, that is just large. We're talking about large sums of money, and it's preventing people from doing things that actually would stimulate the economy. So if we were to cancel all student loan debt, which is about $1.8 trillion right now, that would boost the United States economy by about $108 billion per year for the next 10 years. There's not a lot of other economic stimuluses that give you that sort of option without, you know, in worrying Democrats and mostly Republicans about, you know, the deficit and these other things. So not only would it, you know, stimulate the economy, it would create jobs. It would create about 1.2 million jobs over the next couple of years. And specifically, it would largely lead to this very large boom of people directly putting cash into the economy in a similar way that we just saw stimulus checks do that same sort of effect, where we give people a $1,200, $600, whatever that amount is. And what do those people often use that money on? They use it on like buying food, paying their rent, things that, you know, technically stimulate the economy, but are basic needs. Unfortunately, also a large chunk of that stimulus is going off to pay other types of debts. So that's why all of this is coordinated, because, you know, we put out a tweet the other day that was like, oh, there's a moratorium, which largely people are covered under, not everyone. You know, what have you been, while you have not had to make these loan payments, what have you been using that money to pay for? So many people are like, I paid off my credit card debt. I mean, it's just absurd that this crisis of indebtedness is connecting everything. But the economic effects of canceling student debt are, in fact, we would gain more by canceling student debt than we do by keeping student debt on government books. We're actually losing money by keeping this debt on the books, because the government is the sole lender. We have a sort of sovereign currency in the United States. The government is the sole lender of these loans. And so if, you know, Tony, if I give you $5, at any moment I can say, you know what, you don't owe me, just keep it. That's my decision. But the economy is not worse off because of that. And that's, you know, the government sort of works the same way. And quickly, I just think so many people don't quite understand this basic concept. I only learned this, I think, last year, that the United States federal government just does not, their budget does not operate the same way that a household budget operates. So if, you know, I can't spend more than I make, or else I'd be in trouble. But the United States government can do that. And in fact, the more they spend, the higher that deficit is, the better, you know, this is for everyone else.
Yeah, we've said that quite a lot here on our own podcast. In Ireland, we have a couple of parties who talk about balancing the books. And, you know, you're not a household, you're a country, you run a different way. Do you see a political opportunity with COVID and recovery from COVID that you could, instead of going back to normal, go back to better?
I do. I really do. And I think the first couple of months of COVID really exemplified very quickly the type of opportunity that we have. I mean, we canceled debts. We allowed people to pause on certain payments. We released prisoners. I mean, we did some of these, you know, abolitionist demands that people have made for decades in an instant. And it seemed rather politically convenient and necessary and kind of common sense, no-brainer kind of thing, because we were obviously and still are in perpetual fear of losing our lives. So that sort of, you know, kicked people into, specifically the federal government, into higher gear. And I wouldn't, you know, it's not worth it. I'm not saying it's worth the hundreds of thousands of deaths that we have, but it's absolutely changed, I think, our framework of what is possible in terms of what's economically feasible. What is our priority? You know, when we ask these sort of questions, like how do we pay for things?
The things
is it worth it?
The things that can't be unseen.
Exactly. Exactly. And no one can unsee. I think, you know, the first, when we passed the CARES Act and early in the pandemic, and, you know, my Facebook was just covered in people being like, are you serious? The government can just pull trillions of dollars out of nowhere? And no one had a problem with it. No one said, where's this money coming from? They said, I need this cash because I'm out of work. I need this cash because I can't afford to, you know, work in the place that I am, and I've been fired or I've been furloughed or let go. So no one, you know, sort of asked those questions. People are not, you know, sitting here like, where now, how is the government going to get that money back?
Well, we've seen that across the globe, where we have a two-tier health system, but we also have a public health system, which you guys don't. And we give out about our public health system, and rightly so, but we saw that when the crisis happened, many of the private hospitals came into the national control overnight. It could be done overnight in the stroke of a pen. And who knew? You know, so you can see those things where people won't be able to, voters won't be able to unsee them, is the hope, and that they will then aspire to better. So I suppose my last question for you is, in terms of aspirations for this, what does real success look like for the debt collective?
I think real success looks like building debtor power. We right now are building out what seems to be the nation's first debtors union, folks coming together, similar like the labor unions we talked about earlier, where people can come together to form debtor power, because the way things are financialized in the United States is just so backwards that you know, the only way that we can sort of leverage that, you know, we don't really have a political left that we should. And so the one way that we can leverage that is through debt or power. So, you know, what does it look like for, you know, a household mortgage debtors union to come together? You know, what would that have looked like in the wake of the 08 crisis, which is actually when a lot of people, especially Black and brown households, lost so much of their wealth? What would it look like for us to come together and form a medical debtors union and make these demands for a universal healthcare system so that we don't have to have medical debt, which I don't know of any other countries that have medical debt. It's ridiculous. So we think success looks like building debtor power to make these sort of demands of write downs and cancellations and better policy, because those things are not only possible, but we really believe that that is the abolitionist future that we sort of deserve, which is not necessarily, you know, abolition is without, but it's also with. We believe, you know, abolition is the presence of healthcare, the presence of housing and all of these other basic needs that are guaranteed for all. But in the immediate, success definitely looks like the elimination of $1.8 trillion worth of student loan debt, which is about 93% of the loans that are held by the federal government.
Braxton, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you very much for coming on and have this talk with us today. I hope in the future we can come back to you and see how you're getting on.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
I really enjoyed that. And I do. We do wish you guys all the best. We will be keeping an eye on it and ask listeners to pay attention across the world, because this is something that we all have to pay attention. I love the way you talked about broadening that, because no, it shouldn't be that you go to hospital and then you leave and you have to, you're left with a big loan. And this is kind of a model that needs to be eradicated. And I like the idea. What you said, abolition? An abolitionist model, there's so much that we could do with abolishing. That's the truth. There's so much that we could do with abolishing. Braxton, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and we will talk to you folks very, very soon. Keep an eye on the Tortoise Shack website as the updates are coming in thick and fast. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.